drink?
No, thanks. Had a drink. Shavua Tov. There's a story about a famous Pakistani physicist by the name of Chandra Wickramasinghe. Do not ask me to spell it, for God's sake. So anyway, he was visiting Cambridge University, and in Cambridge University, there was another famous physicist there, Jacques Chirac. Dirac. And Dirac had a... Jacques Dirac had a reputation, actually still does, I believe he's alive, has a reputation for being very stern and very difficult to get along with. And so Chandra Wickramasinghe was extremely nervous about meeting him. And he was eating in Cambridge University, what they call the high table, which is where the a dining room where the top academics dine. And Wickramasinghe is told by the butler, you'll be dining with Mr. Dirac. And he was very nervous, and he said to the butler, he said, what's it safe to talk about? What's a good topic to talk about with him? He said, the weather is always a safe topic in England. You know, it's always lousy, right? I mean, so it's always a safe topic in England. So Wickramasinghe says, okay. So he sits down, and he says, good evening, my name is Chandra Wickramasinghe. And Dirac says, Dirac. That's okay. And he says, little windy outside, isn't it? Dirac gets up and leaves. Oh my, I mean, the first 10 seconds of the conversation, he gets up, he leaves. But about a minute later, Dirac comes back in. And he sits down, he says, yes, it is, isn't it? As a total scientist type, right, he was not prepared to say, yeah, it's windy, unless he went outside. And that, said, Wendy, comes back in and says, yes, it is, isn't it? Right? Not an easy person to get along with, as you can imagine. But I think we can learn a great lesson from this. Very often when we talk about subjects like Torah or science, when scientists speak about Torah, and sometimes when Torah Jews speak about science, they don't bother to go outside and check if it's actually windy or not. Right? That is to say, they will talk from a lack of knowledge. A friend of mine, mentor of mine, Rabbi David Revson, who is the head of Neve Yerushalayim and many other schools, you may have heard of him. So Rabbi Revson was at a conference on science and religion once. And the first speaker was a man by the name of Robert Jastrow. Robert Jastrow is a astrophysicist, hence his nickname Astro Jastrow. His grandfather is quite famous. His name was Marcus Jastrow. He wrote a dictionary of Aramaic in the Talmud. So anyway, it was popular before Art Scroll, but you know, people used to use dictionaries and stuff. Anyway, so Robert Jastrow, Astro, was the first speaker at this conference, and he starts off by saying, "I don't know much about religion, but my feeling is that it's basically reciprocal ethics." And he proceeded to give his understanding of religion and Judaism. So Rabbi Revson's second speaker gets up and he says, "I don't know much about astronomy, but I think it could be summarized by twinkle, twinkle, little star." Jastrow was a little upset. Rabbi Revson afterwards said to him, "Why are you upset? You did the same thing with religion. You start off by saying, I don't know much about religion, but here it is. So I don't know much about astronomy, here it is." Right, so we have to be very careful here very often when we are intruding on each other's fields. Whether it's science or religion, you get all types of bizarre things. I know of a yeshiva where they banned a certain cereal because the box of cereal had pictures of dinosaurs on the back. So and so clearly, even though it had a hechsher, this is treif, right? Because we're not allowed to look at dinosaurs for some reason. I don't know why. But okay, I mean, if you believe they didn't exist, so they're not treif animals, hence no big deal, right? And if they did exist, well, they existed before there was such a thing as treifus, so therefore it doesn't matter either. Either way, I'm not sure exactly what the problem was. But there was a problem with this cereal. Okay, so they killed the cereal, hence they were serial killers, and that was the end of it. Right, so what I'd like to... Sorry about that, I couldn't resist. So anyway, what I'd like to discuss, and you saw in the title, The Ox, the Razor, and Torah. And I will try to explain that title at some point during the class. Right, always a good idea. Right, so let me start. I used to often come late to class when I was in high school, not was not because I have, not because, you know, as I have chronic lateness syndrome, I used to be struggling with it my entire life, right? But anyway, the teacher did not understand that I was a part of a persecuted minority, and he was extremely upset about the fact I used to come about an hour late for a two-hour class, often. So he says, one day I walk in late, and he says, Becha, where were you? And why are you late? I said, well, my father's car broke down. He could not take me to the bus stop. Hence, I had to walk to the bus stop and, you know, hence I'm late. And the next time I was late, he said, Becca, why are you late? I said, my dog was sick this morning. I had to take him to the vet. It was an emergency. And so, hence, I'm late. Third time, I'm late. He says, Becca, why are you late? I said, the tram in Melbourne, Australia, where I grew up, they have trams, which are these electric trolley cars in the middle of the street. I used to take a tram to school, which passed by the route it took from my home to Yeshiva High School, past every major private Christian school in Melbourne, which is interesting because I was the only person with a yarmulke, but I never, ever had any problems because one of the first schools we passed was a Scotch Presbyterian high school, and Scotch College, the prefects, that's guys who are in charge of their particular class, used to have to wear kilts. Understandably, if you've got guys with dresses on the tram and one guy with a little thing on his head, right, I'm totally safe. I mean, why would they even bother with me? So wearing a thing on my head, there's a guy with a dress. Yeah, he's just got a skirt. So I have eternal thanks to the Scotch Presbyterian Church for saving my life during high school. So anyway, I told him that the tram broke down. There was an obstruction on the tracks, which does happen every now and again, usually dead motorcyclists. And so I could, you know, hence it was delayed. And so the fourth time I came late, he said, Becher, don't bother. He said, don't bother. He says, you, he said, are a goring ox. He said, you are a shor hamuad, a goring ox. So I'm saying, what the heck? What is he talking about? So everyone knows, right, from the Torah, in Exodus 22, I think it is, right? The Torah describes the following. Goring ox. What is a goring ox? I mean, people have this impression that in ancient Babylon, there were oxen running around the city, right, goring people right and left. It was like, oh, right. But the basic situation is this. You're taking your ox, you've got a pet ox, Fifi, right? And you're taking Fifi for a walk, okay? So you're walking along with Fifi on the leash or whatever it is, right? And another ox walks in the opposite direction. Fifi sees the other ox, goes nuts, and gores the other ox. Okay? Gores the other ox. So now, how much do you have to pay? You caused $100 worth of damage to the other ox, right? How much do you have to pay to the owner of the other ox? So if you look in the Torah tells us half of the damage that was caused. You only have to pay half. You only have to pay $50. Why? Answer is probably very simple, because generally oxen are not vicious creatures. You don't hear about ox attacks all the time. I mean, you hear about pit bulls and Rottweilers. You very rarely hear of someone's ox attacking someone. Right? So it's not, they're not vicious animals. Hence, it was not the type of thing that you should anticipate. And hence, your regular leash or whatever you precautions you took should be considered sufficient. You've taken sufficient precautions. You're not held completely responsible. Partial responsibility, yes, because it is your ox, but not complete responsibility because this is an unanticipated, unlikely consequence. Is this clear so far, everyone? Okay. Now, the Torah tells us, however, im shor nagachu mitmol shilshom, if, however, it was a goring ox, it has a criminal record. It's done this three times. Mitmol shilshom, yesterday, the day before. This is now the third time, some say, the fourth time, whatever. Right, but it's done it before. It's happened already three times. Now, Fifi does it again. So how much do you have to pay the owner of the other ox now if Fifi caused $100 worth of damages? The answer is the full amount. Why? So basically, the full amount, what happens is that Fifi is no longer called your average ox, shortum. Fifi is now a goring ox. So that's the simple explanation of goring ox. And my teacher, the rabbi in the yeshiva in Melbourne, called me a goring ox. And so I didn't really understand what that was about, but it was explained to me later on. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik explains the idea of the goring ox. What's the concept here? He says, you see, you've got three incidents. Fifi gored three times. Okay? It gored three times. The inconvenient truth is that Ox gored three times. So Fifi has done this three times. So anyway, now Rav Chaim Soloveitchik puts it this way. You could say that the first time Fifi gored is because she had too much caffeine for breakfast. And the second time was because she had sun in her eyes. And the third time was because she was provoked. And you'd have three satisfactory explanations of three different incidents, right? He says, or you could give one answer that explains all three. What's the one answer that explains all three? Goring ox. Fifi's vicious. Very simple, right? So he says, whenever we have a situation of three incidents, etc., three phenomena, and you could give an independent explanation for each, or you could link them all together. You can give one explanation that explains all three. We always go for the one that explains all three. Is this clear so far? This principle is called chazaka, but in science, this principle we find as well. It is known as Occam's razor. Anyone heard of Occam's razor? Occam, Occam is a place, but there was a fellow by the name of William of Occam. It's a place in England. William of Occam was a philosopher, a scientist, cricket player, whatever. And William of Ockham developed the idea. The way he put it was, plurality should not be posited without necessity. To put it in other words, what the Torah already said, which is, if you can give one explanation for three phenomena, or you can give three explanations for the three, the one is always better than the three. In other words, and what he means by Ockham, it's called Ockham's razor, it's the idea that cut away the garbage. Simplify your answer, right? In other words, the most elegant, simple answer is usually the most accurate and truthful answer, right? And indeed, that is a principle which we find works very often. There's a certain elegance to it. You know, if someone would tell you that the formula that opened up the entire concept of nuclear physics, that opened up nuclear energy, atomic energy, etc., that formula that describes the relationship between matter, and energy, right, you'd expect an entire blackboard full of symbols, right? Something like out of this, you know, with a mad scientist cackling, right, etc. But actually what you have is a very simple, elegant formula, E equals MC squared, right? Einstein's famous formula. Very simple, very elegant. And Einstein looked at it in the same way. Einstein said that one of the ways I choose something as being correct, he says, is if it's elegant, beautiful, simple. An elegant, beautiful simplicity is what we are looking for. And that is what the idea of Occam's razor is. Why do I start with this and mention this? Because the truth of the matter is, this, I think, is the basis of much of science. The basis of so much of science is the idea that we are looking for unity. We're looking to tie things together. You see separate phenomena? You see separate things happening? So the ancient pagan, the polytheism, many gods, polytheism. I was talking about this with my kids once at lunch, Shabbos lunch, about polytheism. So one of my sons, who's now 16, but at the time he was, I think, 11, he says, is that where politics comes from? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, poly means many, and ticks are small blood-sucking parasites. So is that, so politics, is that how it works? So anyway, so I'm not sure, but it would be a case where entomology and etymology meet, if that was true. In any case, right, the idea of a polytheist who believes in multiple forces in the world, multiple gods. So your ancient, he's living on some island in Polynesia, right, etc., somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, okay, and there's an earthquake. And maybe a little while later, there's a tidal wave, a tsunami, and maybe also the volcano explodes. Will he tie them together?